Hello, welcome to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Bruyere, and tonight's show is called the Iowa Terror Show with Mike Palachek. And if you've never read any of Mike Palachek's book, you're missing out on something. He's an amazing humorist and satirist, and he's also just incredibly politically savvy, and he knows how to get his message across. He has also done some serious books, and he put together with a couple of other great folks a wonderful giant coffee table book called Cost of Freedom, which is an anthology of dissent, really, since September 11th, and it's got some beautiful poetry and writings, contributions from people all over the country who are trying to keep freedom and democracy alive in this country. And Mike has an amazing history. He's a former Omaha resident, and he served 5 jail and prison terms during the 80s for protests at Offutt Air Force Base, and he crossed the line at the base on many occasions to say no to the military and its surge toward global domination. And he's been in many county jails as well as federal prisons, so he has a very interesting past. And he also was a seminarian. He also tried to get the Omaha Catholic Church to announce the Strategic Air Command. The bishop denied his request. Even though the cathedral was surrounded by FBI agents, Palachek was able to slip past them and go underground for a couple of weeks, pursued by the FBI, but he ended up giving himself up at a press conference. In fact, he's such an incredible character that I should probably have him tell these amazing stories rather than I am. I'm really rather in awe of him. Mike, welcome so much. Welcome to the show. Mike, can you hear me? I can't hear you.
Uh-oh.
Oh, I can hear you now.
Can you? Okay.
Yeah.
How you
I'm
doing?
Sorry, I'm so technological. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And I was just, I don't know if you heard me start to introduce you, but you have just such an extraordinary background. And I was talking about you going on the lam and finally giving yourself up there. You have a long history of activism. I think you're one of the bravest activists I know, and I'm really interested in your past, as well as you've also gone on these big book tours too. So I have a feeling you probably have a lot to tell us about the difference between what the polls show and what people actually think about what's going on in the country these days. Do you want to?
I went on a couple of book tours this past year, I just got back from a Western book tour, and it was a continuation of the previous year's book tour. It was the American Dream American Dream book tour. I started that in the spring of 2007. I live here in Northwest Iowa, Shelton, Iowa. It's a town of about 5,000, and I've been trying to write for about 14 years, but I'd never gone, never really given a reading, and I didn't really want to, but I decided that I needed to give that a shot, so I arranged these book tours, and last year I went east. Actually, I was supposed to go around the country, but I ended up cutting it short in Boston, and I continued it this year with 2 books. It was Iowa Terror, which is a short illustrated novel, and Cost of Freedom is an anthology of stories of peace people, peace groups around the country, and it's a celebration. You know, we haven't done all that we want to do. We haven't stopped the war yet, but we have done some things, and there have been many people who have been courageous. So Cost of Freedom is a celebration of that. So that's kind of what I've been doing the last year.
Well, I love Cost of Freedom. It's just wonderful to see the stories and the pictures and the poetry and know that there's so many of us. And I think that is really probably the great untold story of our time, is the fact that there are people doing weekly vigils all over the place. Everyone is upset about the way... Maybe I shouldn't be saying this. In fact, I want to ask you this, because I know in the wake of September 11th, I started a weekly vigil just to let people know you could still do this in the United States. And, you know, a lot of people were afraid to show dissent in the wake of September 11th and to protest. But a lot of us were out in the streets early. And it's not just us here in the Bay Area, right? There's people all over the place.
That's right. If you know, I think it's great that you started the week after. I mean, a lot of us didn't, I don't know. Well, what I did was I put a sign on our fire hydrant out in front of our house that said the Air Force is our terrorist, and that was torn down every day. And I wrote a letter to the editor, and there was a policeman that came to the door and said that he had gotten a tip that said I was associated with Osama bin Laden, and he was just checking it out. But, you know, those were in those times, that's the kind of thing that happened. And, it was really strange. And you heard Kate Smith singing on the radio, God Bless America. And to me, that was a scary thing, a very frightening thing that kind of portended what we were heading towards. And it was really scary. And yeah, there are people all over. I think of my first stop on this past tour was in Tulsa. And it's the Bible Belt. I found that out. I mean, I guess I knew that, but they told me. And there's a group down there that really gets it, and that are really fighting, and they're working for Cynthia McKinney and the Green Party presidential candidate, and they're doing all these things. And there are people. Bisbee, Arizona, there was a great group. In Tucson, there's a great group. Amarillo Peace Farm. They really are everywhere. No matter if you just have time to go to all these places. You know, I kept telling people throughout the tour in my talk that I think that no matter how small of a town, there's somebody who's going through something, who has really fought Bush in his or her hometown, either by writing a letter to the editor or maybe wearing a button to work where it wasn't maybe too easy to do that. And, you know, writing a letter to the editor in a small town or a large town can be a tough thing to do, because you write that letter and it gets printed and you go out your door and you meet your neighbors, and it can be a tough thing. But there's people all over, and some of the stories are in the book, and there could be a few more books to tell all the stories.
Oh, I don't think you could actually get them all the stories in the books. I mean, just even now, we had a big impeachment event, and what is heartening is to know that there's so many towns and counties and states that are trying to get impeachment resolutions passed, and just to show that, hey, there's a lot of the country that recognizes that this is a criminal regime trying to push Congress to fulfill their oath of office and, you know, not give them more money, for heaven's sakes, but to stop these guys. So it is heartening to me that you were able to put together that beautiful book, and I really recommend it to folks, especially folks who feel isolated. I know I've been doing the weekly. Actually, I stopped doing it. I started it in October 2001, and I thought the most nonviolent response to the terrorist attack and a war would be a listening project. And that's what I did every week for 6 years. But
every week for 6 years, man, that is really something. That really is.
But in 2007, I started doing the radio show, and the radio show takes like at least 3 days a week. So between my husband was telling me, you know, Carol, you can't do everything. You're going to have to stop something. And one of the local activists, his name was Cosmos, and he started 9/11 Truth Action. And he was trying to get everyone to do actions on the 11th of every month. And I was like, Cosmos, it's hard enough to do it every week, but I can't do it every week. And I was doing impeachment rallies every month, plus the weekly you know, listening project, and the meetings for Northern California 9/11 Truth Lines and other stuff. And it was just like way too much. So I had to just cut back on my listening project to once a month. And I started doing it on the 11th of every month, because by late 2007, Cosmos had groups doing it all over the country and in cities in Europe as well as Australia. So it became an international thing. And so it was nice to go out on the 11th and know that even if it was small, at least it was in solidarity with all these other small actions all over the group. And then Cosmos is really good at getting the photos and the videos and putting up on the internet. So even if you have a little action, it has a ripple effect. People see you and know that you're out there, and it gives courage to other folks, which is really nice.
The listening project, what is that? Or what was that?
Well, I actually was inspired by a woman from Colombia. And Colombia, of course, has horrific violence. And so they felt that one reason that there was so violence was a failure of communication. And if you could listen and talk to people, then you don't have the need for violence. And so it worked in Colombia. And I thought, well, let's try it here in the United States. And so I asked three questions. In fact, I still ask the same three questions. The first one was, what do you think, feel about the events of September 11th and the U.S. government's response? The second was, how do you think we can defuse violence? And then the third one was, how can we create a safer, better world for ourselves and other people? And the beauty of the questions is usually by the time people have answered those, I have some idea of where they're getting their information from, what their values are, and where to begin a conversation. And I've interviewed people, and I've spent like an entire hour, sometimes more than an hour, talking to people, and then people become my friends, and then they help me. And the little itty bitty listening project, I mean, that was really the nucleus of the Northern California 9/11 Truth Lines, and all the 9/11 Truth events that, you know, I've organized out here in the Bay Area, you know, have indirectly been a result of that listening project and the street actions and the tabling where people come and help me. So the group has grown. And that's, I think, why Cosmos does the street actions, because when you're in the street, you connect with people in a very direct way. I've done a lot of visuals where you just stand up with signs, and I don't really like that a whole lot, because people will honk or give you a thumbs up. But it's when you actually, I think, engage in a dialogue or a conversation that you have a much more meaningful exchange. And then it's quite possible to develop allies. And then also, I was doing it too because I thought that the polls were really misleading. And by asking questions, then I'd know if there was this big disparity between what they said the American people thought and what people actually thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I learned too is that over time, people who might have been Republican and pro-Bush initially changed sides. You know? And it was really nice to see them in the anti-war marches and saying, "You were right." So that was. I'm sorry, I've been talking too much, but I'll let Mike talk when we come back from this break.
Great host, great topics, free speech at its best. This is We the People Radio Network.
War is over if you want it. Peace.
Peace. P-E-A-C-E. P-E-A-C-E.
So this is springtime. The years have been dark. The sun is now shining.
Welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. This is Carol Brier, and I'm speaking with Mike Palacek, the author of Iowa Terra and The American Dream, and some other books as well. And Mike, I really shouldn't have been talking so much, but I'm really interested in your background. And it seems like you're one of the most ardent activists doing everything that you can to wake up this country. And for you, the best thing is writing and book tours to get your message out. What do you think?
Well, you know, it doesn't feel like that to me that I'm doing so much. I mean, the jail time was back in the 80s. I mean, there were five jail terms, but a lot of them were short, 10 days, 30 days, 50 days, and there's twice 6 months. But and it was quite an experience. What happened was I had to, in 89 was my last time in jail, and it was 6 months in the Council Bluffs, Iowa County Jail, and I just kind of went nuts in jail. I just was super depressed, clinically depressed. I had to take Xanax to get through the term. And anyway, I guess it was post-traumatic stress, whatever disorder or whatever you call it. And I went into journalism from that. And I was trying to do my thing through being a reporter. And I was in my first job, and it was in western Nebraska in the Sand Hills. It was a small town about, I'm not sure what the circulation of the paper was, maybe about 1,000, but I just started this column, and the Gulf War started, and it was my first column, and the mantra back then was the same as now, is we support the troops, and there's yellow ribbons all over, and this is really very conservative cowboy country, and I wrote that I did not support the troops. And so, you know, the column was canceled, and we got a few threats, and we just decided to leave. And I don't know, I just kind of had my bubble burst on journalism. I thought that, you know, I found out that it's about money. You know, the publisher said that he wasn't going to piss off a bunch, you know, his advertisers and lose money over something journalistic. And I just, you know, I just had not really expected that. I expected more from them. But I continued in journalism for a while, and then I decided that I wanted to try and start writing novels. And so I thought if I was going to write novels, I should read a couple. So I started reading in 94. Ruth and I had a small newspaper in southeastern Minnesota, and we had two children then. And I just decided to try and learn how to write, so I went to the library and got writing books, and I've been trying ever since. And yeah, writing novels is kind of my thing. I try and fight the war, or fight through books, through novels, which is kind of it might not be quite to the point. It might not, it's not going getting arrested, but I guess it's kind of my way. And I don't know. I enjoy doing it, and there's been kind of limited success. But you know, it's just like anything else, I suppose. You just keep pushing at it, and maybe someday you get the big breakthrough where you do some good. The frustrating thing is you're sitting in your any writer, you know, you're sitting in your room wherever you write or outside or whatever, and your people are dying, and there's poor people in the streets, and you're writing this stupid novel about it to try and affect that, and it just doesn't happen as quick as you want it to. And that's kind of it's frustrating to be working at it that way, but maybe over time, I'll see over the years how this works out.
That's interesting. I just came from a journalism conference, and there were all these investigative journalism journalists, and I can't help feeling that, you know, usually the real block is getting things published, and that people often turn to novels because they can't get the hard stuff printed, and they're trying to sneak it out in a different form. Mm-hmm. To reach people's consciousness. But if you have a newspaper, or you did have a newspaper, you could have, or did you do like investigative journalism too before, or was it basically opinion pieces or straight journalism?
Well, it was a small paper, about 1,000. We won the newspaper, Minnesota Newspaper of the Year award in 1994. And then we went out of business later that year. But, you know, as a member of that, I don't know, pub journalism community, even as with a tiny, tiny paper, I felt like, you know, well, maybe I can do something because it's my paper. If I have an idea, I can print it. So I remember writing to Ted Kennedy and asking him if he wanted to talk about, you know, the assassinations, because to me, you know, I just think that the JFK and RFK and MLK and all those are just, you know, I think they're still integral. They're just the core of what we need to know and who we are, and we did to find the truth out, and that all led to 9/11. But I didn't hear back from him, but I heard back from somebody that in his office that he didn't want to discuss it. And then it was a time of it was early 90s, and Leonard Peltier was having an appeal in St. Paul Federal Court, and so I thought, well, geez, I can do this. I don't have to ask anybody if I can investigate this. You know, it doesn't really go with community journalism. You're supposed to just cover your local, and that's how you make money, is you cover local things that the bigger papers don't cover. But still, as a, you know, so I went and interviewed Leonard Peltier in Leavenworth, and I had been there as an inmate not that long ago overnight. And I talked to him about it, and I talked to an FBI agent, head of the Midwest FBI agent in Minneapolis, and he had been the head of the Omaha FBI agency when I was underground, and so he was the one who was kind of pursuing me back then. And so here I was interviewing me as a reporter, it was a way to look at. It was a way to be able to get close to the Peltier case, which I think is also, you know, it's just so interesting, and it's just a shame. I don't know. I went to Oglala and kind of walked around where the agents were killed, and to be there, and, you know, of course I read Matthiessen's book and all that, but yeah, that was fun to be able to do. But yeah, novels are, I'm going on here, but I think novels are a way to tell the truth. You write fiction in order to tell the truth. That's how I see it. And each time I try and write a novel, I try and write The Grapes of Wrath, because to me that's a very readable, entertaining book that also has a message. And I just look at the... Hello?
Hi. I was wondering if you got cut off or something or not.
No, I just stopped suddenly.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad, because last week I lost like the last 6 minutes. So please continue.
Well, I thought I was going on too long, so I wanted to stop. I wanted to take a breath.
Oh, okay. But you might not be able to tell this, but I've had a horrific cold. So when I was at this journalism conference, I could hardly talk, and I still don't have my real voice back. It's still all scratchy and kind of like a frog or something. So you should be talking on me.
you're where? In what city? You're in San Francisco, or is that where you are right now?
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto. Okay. All right.
Yeah. And it's a great place to be as far as there's lots and lots of activism, but then again, many of the problems are rooted here too.
Is it north of San Francisco? Is that right?
No. We're south of San Francisco.
South of San Francisco. Okay. Well.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have a break, and
okay,
we'll be back with Mike Palachuk. It's Palachuk or Palachuk?
Palachuk, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was Palachuk.
anyway, it's fine.
Okay.
The Alex Jones Show, broadcast live from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Central, Monday through Friday, right here on We the People Radio Network.
Hello, George. Yeah, the framers of our Constitution, fresh on the heels of the Revolution, but it must have seen the writing on the wall. They secured for us an open door in Article 2 in Section 4 to commence a presidential overhaul. Now we've run this play a few times before with presidents and judges and governors, and now we see that our country is in distress. With thousands dying, Bush go lying, illegal torture, illegal spying, this is so much bigger than the stain on an intern's dress. I-M-P-E-A-C-H, seven little letters gonna set us straight.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Bay, and I'm speaking with Mike Palachuk, and that was Tom Chelson singing. And I still think impeachment is probably the best cure for the country. And I think the biggest problem is still the media just not even mentioning it, or the fact that if you trash the Constitution, lie to Congress, spy on your citizens, that those are impeachable offenses. Those are high crimes. And Mike, where you are right now in the community that you're living in, are most people awake or against the war? Are they still sort of sleeping? What's the state?
Well, it's Northwest Iowa is a very conservative Dutch area. It's a Republican stronghold, actually, and I don't think you see any Bush Cheney stickers except ones that I guess they have been on there for a long, long time. But I don't think things have really changed much here. I think that people are pretty much going along with what's happening, and that's really oppressive, depressing. I'm sure it's not the same as it is. You know, there are other places that are a lot better, but this is just an unusual. I hope it's unusual part of the country. It's just super conservative. But that's when I ran for Congress in 2000. I was trying to fight against that. I was trying to, to instill some talk about the war, talk about the military into the political discussion, but. Yeah, I don't see too much going on here, sadly to say.
But Mike, didn't you get like over 50,000 votes?
Yeah, I did. I got 67,000. That's 29% of the vote back in 2000. And yeah, I'm happy about that. It's been a while,
and that was as a Democrat, right?
As a Democrat, I'm a Democrat. I remember as a kid asking. It was the Kennedy against Nixon, and I remember being in the kitchen looking at my parents and asking them what we were, a Democrat or a Republican, and they told me so. So I've been a Democrat ever since just because of that. I've got in my head this thing about the Kennedys, it's just ingrained in my head and my heart that, you know, in third grade in Catholic school, I was... The nun came. The principal came into the office, you know, into the room, and she never does that except, you know, maybe to tell that some student has had a car accident or something. But she never comes into the room, and she came in that I think it was around noontime and said the president had been killed. So you remember that, and I remember when Robert Kennedy was killed was. I remember my mother telling me that he will live. You know, that's what this country needs, and of course he didn't. And I just think of the Democratic Party as having something deep within itself, some kind of hope and some kind of power. And that's why I ran, I think there is the potential there, and it's so rarely seen. And I guess I try and talk about that in Iowa Terror too, that the potential for the Democratic Party is great. But what I think we see is pretty limited.
Well, I know Cynthia McKinney struck me as like the best congressperson in the last few years in Congress. And And I ran in 2006, basically, so she wouldn't be all by herself.
Really?
There should be more people like Cynthia McKinney who are out there championing people and justice, the oppressed, and speaking truth.
She is great.
Yeah, and then she was out here, and I asked her about the Democratic Party and whether she felt she had divorced from it, because she was being courted by the Green Party to be the presidential candidate. She said, well, you know, there was never a marriage. It was never consummated, so I don't think you could call it a divorce. She said the Democrats never did anything for her, that she was a complete grassroots candidate. And then when she was actually in Congress, the Democrats gave her zero support. They literally crucified her, just like the press did, over those incidents. And she felt like an outsider. Even when she was in Congress, she felt
that's
like
interesting.
She was very much an outsider. And I think that's one reason that she joined the Green Party. But she said it wasn't just her too, and I have noticed it as well. The Colleen Rowley, she was out here for a media summit in January, and she also ran as a Democrat in an election, and she was Woman of the Year. People know who she is. She was on Time magazine, the cover. And she lost the election, and she said the Democrats didn't support her. They only gave support to the pro-war, pro-corporate candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in some ways they've sold out, and I think you can just tell by their treatment of Denis Kucinich. I mean, they did everything they could to threaten Denis and to shut him up, and he was the bravest after Cynthia on impeachment, and he, you know, was basically discouraged from running for president and told you better hang on to your seat, and then his brother died, and you know, who knows what kind of pressures went on Dennis, but I know he was supposed to announce articles of impeachment against Bush last January, and he couldn't. He was just fighting for his life. But I think the people supported him. I think he won that particular battle for the primary, like 3-1 against his opponent, who had a lot of money and backing from the Democratic Party and probably the Republicans as well.
How did it go for you in your run?
Well, I must say I'm not a very traditional, good, you know, politician candidate. And I was basically asked to run by my local county Green Party, and of course I had never done anything like that before, and I became an activist when Anna Escher, who was my opponent, was elected to Congress. And I still remember those first, I think they had gerrymandered a new district, so it was completely open. And so I've seen her whole career, as I have also had my stint as an activist. And I went to the candidates forum to raise the 9/11 issue back in 2004. And the League of Women Voters would not even let me raise a question. They threw me out. And all the candidates were pro-cover-up and wouldn't touch 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so I had to stand up and make a statement and get thrown out of the room by the League of Women Voters. So the reason I ran was so that I could participate in the forum and talk about something mm-hmm. that was completely taboo.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I thought, well, if people wake up, then they'll have an alternative to a corporate pro-war candidate. So that's basically why, you know, I ran and I was on the ballot. But I all my energy has gone into organizing. I didn't, you know, make bumper stickers or literature or buttons or do any of the traditional advertising, selling yourself as a candidate. I really just continuing. I'm so busy, my organizing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And being a mom. But at least that way people could vote for a Green Party person.
And
vote against her, which was nice. We have another break, and we'll be back with Mike Palachuk in just a few minutes on We the People Radio Network.
News, politics, cover-ups, government corruption. You're listening to We the People Radio Network.
WTPRN.
The call is out across the land, the impeachment of Bush. For crimes and lies, you'd like to see him kicked out on his push. Friends, you've got good reason. I support you absolutely. But this impeachment season, don't forget your civic duty. Impeach Cheney first. It can still get worse. After Bushes and Cubs, it's liable to get rough. Impeach Cheney first.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. This is Carol Brouillet speaking with Mike Palachuk. And Mike, I have to say, Webster Tarpley, who suggested that I do a radio show, also said everyone should run for Congress. And I think it's a really good experience for people to have, to learn what kind of hoops and things you actually have to go through and what the process is, and also to discover, you know, what's really going on with our electoral system as well. I mean, I've found it an extremely educational experience. Can you tell me a little bit about what you did when you ran? Were you just on the ballot, or did you get signs and give speeches and talks and run around your district?
I tried to do it all. I tried to be the candidate as much as I could. I didn't have a group. I didn't have any money. I just told my wife that I think I wanted to do this. So I found out how to do it. It's a lot of work. I had to get all the signatures myself. The district here is 30 counties, and you have to get a certain percentage of the registered voters at each county. I think you could skip a couple, but I had to drive around and go door to door and get the signatures. That's a big thing. But
How many did you have to get?
I don't remember anymore. I don't know if it was 1,000 or more than 1,000. I'm not sure, but it was a lot. It took me a long time to do it. It took me months and months to do it, actually. But it was, wow. I was just so motivated to get, because like you, I wanted the people to have a chance to vote for somebody who was actually against the war, against prisons, and in favor of immigration.
Tell me something, though. For me, actually, the best part about running was going door to door and meeting people and talking to them and gathering the signatures. It's like, that's the best part.
That's you, though. It was hard work. I mean, yeah, you get surprised and you meet, and that some people, you know, want to talk to you and whatever. But I was really apprehensive about it at first. You know, with me, it was just kind of like writing the novels. I like, who am I to be doing this? So I have to get over that first. But no, I don't know. For me, I don't know what the good part was. I think it was just the idea of being able to say this. I mean, it was a forum to, you know, if you're the candidate, you know, people will come to talk to you and ask you what you think, and they'll put it in the paper, and you can say things like cut the military budget, and it'll go in the paper, and finally something gets in the paper, and that's a reason to do it. What I did was we bought this old pickup, and we had a vinyl sign, and it cost. I don't know what we could afford it, though. We had an old pickup with a topper, so I would go to these busy intersections around the country, and I'd sit there and for hours and hours as the traffic goes by, and that would be my advertisement. And we did the parade thing and all that, and speeches as much as I could. And yeah, it was all right. It's really hard because I'm not really one to do that. I don't like to do it, but it's worth it. You know, it really is. It's worth trying. Yeah. And
I think it's probably very different too in Iowa than it is in California. But I know I was running as a Green Party, which is a third party, so we're just basically totally ignored. And a friend of mine was running for Senate in San Francisco, and she was in the paper all the time until she became a candidate, and then they just didn't mention her at all. So we actually, unless you paid a lot of money for advertising, you didn't get your things, what you had to say in the paper. It's actually harder. I mean, I'm sort of a candidate incognito because I was getting more press as an activist. If they knew I was a candidate, then they wouldn't say, they would have read what I say. So that was my experience. I mean, when I was running, it was when 9/11 sort of broke the mainstream press media barrier, and yep. NBC came to my house, and I had several interviews on television, but they would not mention that I was a candidate.
Really?
No, they wouldn't. It was like, oh, well, we won't talk about that. We won't mention it. They wouldn't even put those things together. So basically, unless the public knew me personally, they had no idea who I was or that I was running, or they just see my name on the ballot, because there was virtually almost zero press. But I did get the traditional, you know, 2% of the green vote. But a lot of people, what's interesting too, I think, for running for office too, is the people who determine the outcome of the elections are a very small percentage of the people who could vote. Most people don't vote. The ones who are registered, only a small percentage of them actually vote. So if you're really running for office, those are the people you target, and it's like the hell with everybody else. But maybe that wasn't the case in Iowa for you. Want to tell me what you experienced?
You mean targeting who? I don't know if I was that sophisticated. I don't know who I was targeting. I guess I was, my campaign was like a shotgun. He just tried to target everybody. But yeah. Well, I knew being the Democratic candidate, that's power. I mean, as a third party, it's a lot tougher, but the Democrat, I had to win the primary and so as the Democratic candidate, you have people have to deal with you. Although like Cynthia McKinney said, the Democratic Party wouldn't have anything to do with me. You know, they would often say things like you can't have money because you're not a viable candidate because you have no money. You know, and it just drives you crazy because they don't really, just like the media, like the Des Moines Register, the reporters would say basically the same thing. They wouldn't really want to talk about the issues. They would talk about how much money have you raised. That's the first question out of their mouth. And when you say, oh, $47 or something like that, then they start laughing, you know, and then all of a sudden you're a joke. And I don't know if that's, you know, maybe because they're so experienced at doing it that they know that they're going to be the outcome, but it's not right. But you still keep pushing on.
It's not right, but I'm just going to tell you a story now. The Green Party, there's a guy who does press work for us, and he's got a heart of gold. He's a member of Veterans for Peace, but he used to work for the government, like putting propaganda pieces about the Vietnam War. When he was in Vietnam, that's what he did. He did press. He did the lies. He manipulated. He manipulated the press, and he knows how to do that really well. But
in Hello Vietnam.
Pardon?
Oh, it was those two twins in Hello Good Morning Vietnam that Robin Williams had to deal with. I don't know. Maybe you didn't see that movie. Sorry.
But I did see that movie. But he says, you know, that we actually do have a chance. It's just that in some ways. Well, Green Party candidates, they're so ignorant, and they generally rely on flyers, and they don't use more sophisticated media, and they never use television because television is way too expensive. But he says he helped a candidate get elected getting really cheap television commercials on CNN News, and the guy was able to get out opposition messages and win, and he didn't have very much money. I mean, I think he spent maybe $1,000 or a couple thousand dollars, but it was strategically placed, you know, on television where people found out about him, and he actually won an election. I don't remember all the details, but I think, you know, our biggest barrier is the media. Another person who ran for public office, who's a 9/11 truth activist, David Kubiak, who was the director of 9/11truth.org, and he ran for a state senate in Maine where they have clean elections. Mm-hmm. So if you get, you know, the signatures, you actually get some money, and there are these progressive states which have passed legislation, which the system is so corrupt right now. I mean, if they say that you could only, it's only feasible if you are corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, only if you have lots of money can you buy yourself a place of power and prostitute yourself for even richer folks. I mean,
I think Kevin Barrett's going to give it a try, right?
Pardon?
Isn't Kevin Barrett trying to run in Wisconsin?
I think so. And I think what is interesting right now is the fact that our media is changing and we can communicate directly via the internet in ways we've never been able to before. And so it opens up all sorts of democratizing possibilities. Although, We'll talk about it when we come back from the break. There's also this huge effort to clamp down on the internet so that it's not a threat to the power elite. And unfortunately, that's happening like right here where I live in Silicon Valley, where my congresswoman is working closely with the NSA. It's horrific, but that's what's going on right now. And here comes the music. So I'll be back with Mike Palachek, and we'll have to talk some more about Iowa Terror and your other books. And
I got
but it's so much fun to digress.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.
Uncover the Truth with Catherine Albright, live from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Monday to Friday.